Good day, everyone. Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
It's Candace LaPage.
And Candace, have you been enjoying second winter?
Yes, though I don't know that I would even call this second winter so much as winter, because we never really got winter. Maybe, do I remember that we got something like November or early December? I don't remember.
But oh, there was a big blizzard in January, because I remember driving in it, because that's when two foxes ran across the road near Riverside Park in front of me.
Right, it started like just after Christmas, right? We had like warm up to Christmas and then sometime between Christmas and the New Year. Yeah, either way, we never really had much winter at all. So yes, I have been absolutely enjoying the weather lately. Thank you.
I'm like, you know, it's good, I guess, you know, real life seasoning for getting into what we're talking about this week. So it was like a really good sort of warm up, if you will, so to speak.
Cool down.
Yeah, there you go. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We're here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new Supernatural comedy sequel, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. Terrible title, but you can see it now in a theater near you. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we also have Ghostbusters-related materials to cover for you. Because this is an interesting factoid. That in the summer of 1984, Ghostbusters opened in June on the same weekend that a very similar, although different movie in the details. But it could also be classified as kind of like a horror comedy, supernatural film with horror elements that can also be very funny. That movie was called Gremlins. So you had Gremlins and Ghostbusters opening on the same weekend, which is, I don't know if Candace will agree with me or not, but that would never happen anymore.
Oh, gosh, no. No, people would be moving out of each other's way.
That's right. It's like, yeah. No, you can't even open two superhero movies on the same weekend. It's interesting to think about this as kind of like a pop culture thought experiment. Like, you know, when you look back, two similar kind of movies and type, same weekend, both kind of have this longevity. People are still watching Gremlins. Gremlins is wicked easy to find on streaming, as is Ghostbusters. Although we're not cranking out Gremlins sequels, and we're going to get to that. One can still comfortably watch both of these movies in the year 2024 and enjoy them on their own merits. So we're going to take this week to pit Gremlins versus Ghostbusters. Which one wins? And we have a variety of categories to go over. But in terms of just like on their own as objective enterprises, if we're to line up almost 40 years of Ghostbusters of Gremlin history, which one wins? So we have five categories to go through. Story, I guess story and script. Team, so that's cast and production. Effects, that's pretty self-explanatory. The music, also pretty self-explanatory. And legacy, which is how both of these franchises, quote-unquote franchises, kind of shaked out over the last four decades. Okay, so we're going to start with story. And story slash script. And you have Gremlins, which is a script by Chris Columbus, who went on to become fairly well-known and successful director. I can't remember if Steven Spielberg like wrote the story or was like the originator of the idea or
yeah,
not.
Yeah, no, I think he... found out about the script from Chris Columbus. Like, I think Chris Columbus came up with the story and everything, and Spielberg found out about it and said, let's do that.
Found scripts. Used to be how Hollywood works. So yeah, that's the background of Gremlins. For Ghostbusters, It's complicated. Dan Aykroyd wrote this like kitchen sink. Because for people who don't know, Dan Aykroyd's like family is like big into spiritualism, so he's was primed to do something like Ghostbusters his entire life. He takes it to Harold Ramis and Ivan Reitman, and they basically pound out a workable version of the story across a couple of weeks staying on Martha's Vineyard. And that, as you say, is that considering that you have people who have experience in improv, Ramis, Bill Murray, Rick Moranis. There actually wasn't a lot of improv in this script, from what I understand. So it is a fairly tightly scripted affair. But Candace, for story slash script wise, what are your thoughts about Gremlins versus Ghostbusters?
Yeah. Well, so my first thoughts about these two movies, because people, and you mentioned it, right? They're kind of like horror comedy sort of things. And I think a big difference between these two movies, I see Ghostbusters as a comedy movie that has horror in it, and I see Gremlins as a horror movie that has comedy in it. To me, the story of Gremlins was always actually about creatures. It's like a creature feature. It was always a horror movie, but they just happened to decide to make it more family friendly, more funny.
Is it
We'll get to that when we get to the legacy part. But
friendly?
Gizmo, for sure,
Oh, for sure,
was
yeah.
made to be merchandised. And in fact, apparently I learned today, because I was reading up a lot about it, the original story actually had Gizmo, excuse me, as the one who turned into the gremlin, not
Right.
Stripe,
Not Stripe,
but
yeah.
Spielberg, genius that he is, was like, no, we got to have this cute little guy in here for the whole movie. People are going to want to see him. And Spielberg was right, as Spielberg is often right. So, in that way, it's interesting, because Ghostbusters is a very well-written comedy film. Like, it's, and everybody who's sort of involved in that are all sort of masters of comedy. And it's something that I think people really understand. Whereas Gremlins is really like a B-movie creature feature that has a very specific sort of story structure and all of that. And that's actually more my wheelhouse, which is why I like Gremlins more. But I think that people didn't know what to expect. So, and even still, I think people sort of watch it and they're like, what? That was so weird. It's like funny, but what? Horrifying at the same time. So it's hard. I mean, it's hard to measure, because they're so different to me, to each other.
I think just on the technicalities of it, like Ghostbusters kind of wins. I th like it was funny rewatching Gremlins. I like it. I maybe don't like it as much as you do. But the plot hole, I don't know if you can call them plot holes, but let's call them the inconsistencies, like the Pritzker house out, like it's a dad who's like clearly like the world's crappiest inventor, but they have like this massive house that I guess Billy's keeping up with his part-time bank salary.
Listen, it's small town Kingston Falls. Like, that house costs nothing.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, this is kind of problematic looking at it from a 2024 point of view, but Mr. Futterman's like borderline stuff about foreigners. And the stuff with Phoebe Cates. Like when she tells a story about how her father died dressing up as Santa and breaking his neck while coming down the chimney, I'm not 100% sure if that's supposed to be funny, or if that's supposed to be like this woman has problems telling the truth and.
And see, this is, that to me is the biggest like marker of the fact that this is like a B movie creature feature, like a Corman, like a Roger Corman sort of thing. And she plays it perfectly, because she plays it totally straight. Like, she is telling this horrible, traumatizing story of her father dying, with the beautiful capper of, and that's how I knew Santa Claus wasn't real. And she plays it straight, which is perfect. And that's what's supposed to happen. And that is sort of the whole thing with B-movies. It's kind of silly, ridiculous creatures that we all are going to buy into, that all of this is really happening. And it happens because the people in it play it like all of this is really happening.
All right, so who should get the point here?
Well, I mean, as much as I love Gremlins, I would agree. Like, Ghostbusters is
okay,
pretty masterfully written.
Okay. All right. 1 point, Ghostbusters. All right, let's get to the team then. With Ghostbusters, you get Reitman as director. He's coming off of Stripes and producing Animal House and being sort of like the comedy guy in the 80s. You got Aykroyd and Ramis doing the script, also co-starring, obviously. You get Bill Murray in there as well, Rick Moranis. You get William Atherton, who was like the oily villain of the 80s, perfectly cast. And then you get like character actors like Ernie Hudson and, of course, Sigourney Weaver in there. So classically theatrically trained Sigourney Weaver. So you on, you know, you get them. In Gremlins, you get Zach Galligan, obviously Phoebe Cates, who we mentioned. You also get Hoyt Axton, who's playing Billy's father, famously the co-writer of Heartbreak Hotel. Like, think about that. Also, the wonderful Dick Miller, who we also talked about as Mr. Futterman. And I forgot about this. Young Jonathan Banks as one of the cops. And then Polly Holiday as Mrs. Deagle, the Potter-esque human villain of the drama. And I guess we can include Frank Welker as the voice of the Gremlins, except for Howard Mandel, who is the voice of Gizmo, of course.
Yeah, I was going to say Frank Welker, but also he's not the only voice of the Gremlins. There's also, I don't remember his name, but the man who does the voice for Optimus Prime.
Peter Cullen.
Yes, he was also one of the voices. And Michael Winslow of Police Academy fame also does voices. So the Gremlins, you know, there's a lot right there in the Gremlins voices.
Surprising amount of representation in the
and
Gremlins.
And of course, Howie Mandel, as you said.
It's funny rewatching it. I was wondering how much in residuals Howie Mandel has made off of Gremlins in his life. But that's neither here nor there. Also, Corey Feldman as the kid next door, the kid who delivers Christmas trees. And Judge Reinhold's in this for a minute.
Yep. Playing it just a nice kind of slightly creepy love interest. It's great.
Yeah, you want to come over to my new apartment and see my cable box? Or yeah, kind of bizarre. Okay, so who wins? Who wins casting in or the team? I forgot to mention Joe Dante as the director of Gremlins too.
Yeah, Joe Dante is the director. Chris Columbus as the writer. So both of those have, you know, great things. You know, Chris Columbus, of course, of Harry Potter fame, as people say, and Home Alone, and and just
Doubtfire.
You know, to me, Gremlins is all about Dick Miller. Like,
go on.
I don't know. He's got like 500 acting credits to his name or something. He was in everything. Every single movie that Roger Corman made, he put Dick Miller in. And then every other horror movie, you know, director started putting him in everything because he was in everything. Like, this is it's a thing. We've got the Wilhelm scream and Dick Miller in everything. That's how it goes. but I would say that this, like, not only is his performance great, like, he's so believable. And even though he is quite racist, and he's meant to be, like, it's not like we're supposed to, you know, also agree with him that the foreigners are all out to get him. Yeah. You know, we're supposed to recognize that he's racist, but yet he also plays it in a way that you kind of love him. Like, you kind of see that, like, you know, he's not a bad guy. He's done his time in the war.
Mm-hmm.
He's just an old drunk. Everybody kind of loves him. You kind of, you know, pat him on the head, and he's like the town mascot that everybody loves. So he plays it so well that you're able to actually, like, love this character who's definitely a problem. But not only that, like, I think you know, to people my age, like when we were kids in the 80s, getting to see him in this role, he was just Mr. Futterman. That was all we knew. Not knowing the legacy of you know, movies he had behind him, and actually continued to have a little bit afterwards. But this was just sort of like a great reintroduction to people of this guy who was so popular in the 50s and 60s. And honestly, like playing the like Dick Miller bingo is one of the most fun things I do when I watch horror movies. And I don't think I would have had that without Gremlins. I wouldn't, like, he would just be, you know, some guy who shows up.
So you're saying Dick Miller trumps Murray, Aykroyd, Ramis, Weaver, Moranis, Hudson, and Reitman alone?
I think he comes close. Maybe not all of them, but if you cut that cast in half, I think Dick Miller against half of that cast definitely trumps. But hey, let's talk about Phoebe Cates.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Everybody loves Phoebe Cates. She's beautiful. She is an amazing actress. She only had so many roles that she was actually in, because she, as we all know famously, has quit acting and has actually really just stuck with that. She's like, I'm happy to, like, you know, stay home and not do the stuff. And as I said in the first part, I think she's just picture perfect in that scene where she explains why she hates Christmas. Like, it's, to me, that's like an award-winning scene. I'm like, that's perfection right there. I don't know how many takes she did. I don't know how much work she had to do to understand, like with Joe Dante, like, sorry, you want me to just play it? How? Okay. But she played it perfectly. Also, Joe Dante, he's great. Creature features, like, he's made the best ones.
I mean,
Piranha, awesome.
He has such like an underestimated run of stuff in the 80s, from like, he probably had, it's not the best segment in the Twilight Zone movie. I think that goes to the George Miller's remake of the five, speaking of Gremlins, the Fear at 5,000 Feet, or I can't remember the exact title of it. But,
Yeah.
But yeah, you get Howling in 81, Twilight Zone the movie 83, Gremlins, Explorers in Inner Space, Amazon Women on the Moon, which he,
The Burbs,
Burbs, Gremlins 2, Matinee. Yeah. Yeah, you kind of talked me into it. One goes to Gremlins for the team. Yeah.
Excellent.
Okay, that brings us to effects. So, you know, ghosts and goblins and stuff, or like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man and in Ghostbusters. I'm not saying any of that was easy, because like, This was like still kind of like the burgeoning days of like the Hollywood effects houses. But with Gremlins, I mean, points for difficulty go way up, because these things have to be lifelike. They have to have animus. They have to have personality. Like that scene in the bar where they're all like drinking and smoking and playing cards and, you know, and then, you know, there's a scene where you see them walk it after Stripe, you know, goes into the Y pool and spawns several hundred iterations of himself. You know, that's very clearly stop motion. Like they set up a little project, but I mean, it kind of go with it. And I think this plays into the creature feature thing you were saying. It's like, when you're watching creature feature, it doesn't matter that you can see kind of where they're cutting corners or where they had to do things. Like, I think this will also play into a bit of the legacy. You couldn't really do Gremlins like this today. It would just be too much. You would see too much, because they would all be CG. There's a tactileness to this that makes it sort of more charming. It's like a real effort. Like, this was like real hard work to like make this movie look as good as it does.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this is part of the reason why I don't really want another Gremlins movie, because I know that it's all going to be CG and it's not going to be believable. But Gizmo was a puppet. So, you know, it had, as you say, real tactile. There was real fur there. When people were holding it, there was real weight. There was, you know, so much life on their faces. And not only was Gizmo really real and tactile, but Stripe, the other one, really was as well. Plus, I would say, again, and this is part of why I consider this to be a horror film with comedy, because when they all go into their cocoons, those, like, things were really slimy. Like,
yeah,
those
they're gross.
Cocoons were super gross. Like, I watched this movie in a backyard at a friend's place. It was like, you know, summertime, like, we're gonna, you know, invite all the kids over, everybody's gonna come over, we're gonna watch Gremlins. And so, again, you know, a bunch of people in my age who all have kids who are, you know, the age that we saw this movie, right? Like, I was 8 when it came out 40 years ago and watched it for consecutive years after that. So, you know, there's kids like 8 to 12 or 14 all playing in the backyard. Okay, great, we put on the movie. The number of kids who just noped out of there by the time those cocoons showed up, and the, you know, the first, like, gremlin is starting to come out, and they're just like, this is too scary. No, I don't want to watch this at all. And they took off. And then the gore, you know, when the mom just goes to town and kills like 4 gremlins.
Yeah.
Which is great. Like, yeah. So much, like, there's blood, there's gore, there's chunks, the food, the animation on the faces. There's so much effect here as compared to Ghostbusters, which is just like marshmallow fluff and some spectral ghosts.
Yeah. Okay, good. That's another point for Gremlins then. That brings us to the music. So in the case of Ghostbusters, you get the Elmer Bernstein score, which is like the little rambling music that has been reused in the sequels. Is just it's a joy. But you also get the Ray Parker Jr. theme song, and the soundtrack itself is pretty memorable. Beyond that, I also would like to extend this to Ghostbusters 2 as well, like, to get that art, that Run DMC remix, or not even, it's not even a remix, but like the sequel version of the song. I think that has a little kitsch to it. And the Gremlins, you get the Jerry Goldsmith music. The Gremlins Rag is also a really memorable piece of music. But also, it has, you know, you mentioned that scene with the mom after the Gremlins hatch. Great use of the Johnny Mathis Christmas song in that.
Yeah, I can never ever hear that song without being creeped out, frankly.
So I think both these movies have great use of music. I'm probably willing to call this one a draw. What do you think?
Yeah, it was hard for me to sort of decide on this one too, because yes, like, I think the Gremlins Rag is probably better than the Ghostbusters theme, but the Ghostbusters has more than just the theme. Like, there's so much more there. So it's, you know,
I mean, it's not just like the Ray Parker Jr. song, which, you know, was kitschy, and, you know, I think they originally wanted like Huey Lewis to do one. But you also get like that Saving the Day song when they're driving to the building, and the National Guard is out. Like, it's a great use of music all around. Also, Dougie Fresh in the Ghostbusters too. I like it. All right, that brings us to the legacy. Now, Ghostbusters, since it came out, there was Ghostbusters 2 in 89. There was the Fee remake reboot in 2016. And then there's been the two legacy sequels, Afterlife and Frozen Empire, which we're going to get to in a second. And Gremlins, you get Gremlins 2, The New Batch, which basically only gets made because Warner Brothers, like, we want a sequel, find Joe Dante, have at it. And he goes completely meta, completely off.
Brilliant.
The script, brilliant. Yes.
Gremlins 2 is leaps and bounds better than Ghostbusters 2.
I agree. But I also think it's an improvement over the first Gremlins 2.
I think it might be also, which says a lot, because I love the first Gremlins movie. Yeah. But Gremlins 2, it takes everything that was great about Gremlins.
Yeah.
And all of the things that you're like, wait, huh? And then it flips it, and it knows exactly what it's doing, and it's great.
And I mean, there are so many great little things in it, but like Tony Randall as the voice of the brain gremlin in Gremlins 2.
Yes, which I have an action figure, like a stand-up. It's the, you know, that's what I have in my house. I've got a Freddy Krueger bobblehead and a brain, you know, stand-up action figure.
But you know, you like John Glover as like the industrialist guy, Clamp, and Robert Picardo's in it. Like Christopher Lee is like the head of the genetics lab. It's like there's so many great, like Hulk Hogan. I mean, Hulk Hogan's become kind of an ass, but it, you know, the weatherman who's dressed like, or not the weatherman, but the guy who hosts like the horror hour, who's like dressed like Grandpa Munster, and then is like covering like covering the siege. It's so great. The thing I think Ghostbusters always kind of had more, I guess, more opportunity to expand, because I think Gremlins became such a joke. It became so tuned to Joe Dante's voice in a way that I don't think Ghostbusters was, because it was a confection of Ramis, Reitman, and Aykroyd. And then you get the real Ghostbusters, which I don't think anyone had anything from the movie had anything to do with, but that became such a thing on its own. But I think just like in terms of like the cultural cohesion of the property, like Gremlins, like you have three Gremlins things. You have the movie, the sequel, and that animated series that came out, which I haven't seen yet, The Secrets of the Mogwai. And that's like all you get. With Ghostbusters, it's kind of almost been diluted, because you get the five movies, you get multiple animated series, comic books. Like the soundtrack is so ubiquitous. You can't say who you're gonna call, because you know what I mean? It's become almost too diluted.
I will also say, though, because not only are we talking about sort of the legacy of the show, of the property, also the cultural impact. And I don't think this is news to anybody, but when Gremlins came out, it was rated PG. Ghostbusters also rated PG, if I remember correctly. But Gremlins was scary to the audience who, with the guidance of their parents, went to go see the movie. And the parents were like, what is happening? You guys said that we could bring our kids to this. And so Gremlins is, you know, sort of forever known as one of the films that created an entirely new category of movie ratings, which I think is a very long-lasting sort of legacy, a big impact on our whole system.
I think that's right. Yeah. And the other thing I was thinking about too, it just occurred to me, when you watch Afterlife and Frozen Empire, you get these little Stay Puft Marshmallow Men, which is, you know, obviously referring back to the first movie. But what are they acting like when you see them in the movies?
Yes, little Mogwais.
Yeah, they're acting like little gremlins. Yeah.
Yeah, even the sound of their little voices.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like, it's just so perverse. Like, when they're like in Afterlife, when they stick a toothpick, one of them sticks toothpicks or three of the others, and then starts roasting them over a barbecue. And I'm like, someone owes Joe Dante a couple of bucks for this. It's
Yeah. And I will say, I laughed. The hardest laugh I had at this movie was when we saw those little Stay Puft Marshmallow Men, and one of them had his arm in the pencil sharpener, and another one was sharpening it, and marshmallow was just oozing out. And I laughed so much. I was alone in the theater laughing. There were a ton of people, and I laughed, and I turned to the person I was with, and I said, yeah, I guess I really am dark, aren't I?
All right, so Gremlins, I mean, Gremlins is so influential, it's influencing Ghostbusters. So I think Gremlins gets the point on legacy, which makes Gremlins the winner here, 3.5 points Woo-hoo! To 1.5 points. I think that was probably pretty inevitable. And I think we're probably going to get more into that in a sec when we start talking about Frozen Empire. So that's going to come up after a brief break for a musical interlude. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
kitchen sewer dragon.
Hold on to your ass!
TV Spangler, you stay inside this car.
I have a ghost to bust.
All right, that was cool.
Gary, come on.
No, I know, I'm sorry. It's just the way she said it. It sounded cool.
Get back in here! I can't hear you over the nuclear accelerator!
Okay, so that was a clip from Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, terrible title. It's the new film from Gil Keen, and it stars Carrie Coon, Paul Rudd, Finn Wolfhard, McKenna Grace, Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Ernie Hudson, Annie Potts, William Atherton, and a cast of thousands, or maybe it just seemed that way. Boy, like I don't like dumping on movies that are kind of inoffensive in a way, but I mean, oh, this cast was stuffed. This cast was so stuffed. And I rewatched Afterlife after I saw Frozen Empire, because I hadn't watched it since it came out in 2021. And I wasn't as annoyed by Afterlife this time, but I'm kind of more annoyed at Frozen Empire now, because the threads that they could have hooked up on from Afterlife, they don't, because it's even more of a legacy sequel this time. And I could have swore the point of making a legacy sequel is you have this connective tissue, you relaunch the franchise, and then you go off and do your own thing. You don't become more of a legacy sequel with the second part, but that seems to be what we've done here.
Yes. As you were mentioning, you were listing off cast, I was like, oh, how deep is he going to go? Because boy, there's a lot of characters. And I don't really remember at what point in the movie, as I was sitting there in the theater, and I thought, wow, this movie is really terribly paced. What is going on? And then I got home and I started writing down all the different sort of story threads. Like, there's Phoebe and the ghost. Yep. There's Phoebe being benched. Yep. There's the mayor.
Mayor Peck.
Yep. There's Kumail Nanjiani's characters. He has like separate sort of story bits with Venkman, with Ray. Like Ray, he goes in and sells the thing. Venkman, he does the pasta bowl on his head.
Yep.
And then there's him like learning how to use his power. There's Trevor and the Slimer. There's Podcast and Ray doing their show. Yep. And then there's Podcast and Ray and Phoebe who go to the library and destroy the lion. And it just, it just goes on. I just keep writing down all these different things. I'm like, can we just get one story? And by the way, why did we even put Paul Rudd and Carrie Coon in this film?
Yep.
Or Finn Wolfhard for that matter?
Yep.
Like the only thing Trevor did was a joke bit with Slimer. Like, what is, I get it. Phoebe obviously is the character. That's who we want to follow.
Yeah.
So great. Like, I'm glad they, you know, even like doubled down on her as being sort of the main person in this film and in this sort of cast. But then we had to split it up with all these other people.
Yeah.
Because then there's still all of the people who work at, Ernie Hudson as, is it, I never remember.
Winston.
Yeah. As you know, his like Ghostbusters Inc. So there's all the folks who work over there too. And it's like, what? And then on top of that, there's even Patton Oswalt in this, who has a great bit, but it's like, why? Why is this movie made up of 35 bits?
He also has a great name. He's Dr. Hubert Wartsky, which I don't think is ever said in the film. I just found that out looking at Wikipedia. He's playing Dr. Hubert Wartsky.
Speaking of things that are never really said in the film, sorry to go off on a tangent.
No, but, please.
So the title is Frozen Empire.
Yep.
And you know, it starts because there's this room of people who've been basically frozen to death.
Yep.
So okay, we've got some sort of like freezing bad guy, and that's the case. We have this big giant demon or whatever who freezes everything and a legend of a fire master who can fight it. But I'm like, did we ever learn why this bad guy freezes things?
Nope.
Or what he's going to do with his freezing?
Nope.
Or how the fire, like, nothing. That's just like, oh, we need to give him some sort of thing that someone else can counteract sometime. Ooh, fire and hot and frozen. There we go. Like, there's no story about this. It's just thrown in there.
And I, from what I understand, like, they were trying to tap into, like, some of the stuff that the real Ghostbusters cartoon did, which is fine. But, like, there were, like, good, understandable villains on the Ghostbusters animated series. Like, there was Samhain. It was, like, the Halloween god that they fought once. And there was Nightmare. Like, there was, like, a character that was, like, the Nightmare god that they fought. Like, there was also an episode of Real Ghostbusters where they go back in time to Victorian England and capture the ghost of Christmas past, present, and future. And then when they go back to the present, everybody's an a-hole because Scrooge was never changed. Like, that's how, that's how, like, the literary ambition of that show, like, that's how dense it was.
But it's still a 25-minute cartoon, though.
True.
Like, you can't make a 2.5-hour movie out of 25 minutes of story. Well, I guess they can. They did. They padded it with all these, like, things. All this, like, oh, remember the first movie when, you know, Rick Moranis had the pasta thing on his hat, on his head? Yeah. We're going to do that.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, yes to all of that. But, you know, there's just, I guess my point was, like, there was kind of, like, they were really cooking on that show, and it feels like we're just lifting stuff wholesale because there's, like, a whole subplot about the containment unit getting full and, like, what's it like in there? And I'm like, well, there was a whole episode of The Real Ghostbusters where they go into, they send Slimer into the containment unit to get the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man for, like, a Stay Puft company promo. Then there's, like, the whole thing with, like, Janine in uniform, and it's like, well, there was literally an episode of Real Ghostbusters where the Ghostbusters, I can't remember the exact details, but, like, something happens to the Ghostbusters and it just leaves Janine and Slimer and they save the day, and Janine's wearing one of the Ghostbusters outfits. It's like, it's, yeah,
and I'm assuming her proton pack is a wrist thing because it was in the movie. And I was like,
I can't remember
that
much.
I'm like, that they gave her that, so it's obviously from something.
Oops. I assume that was ripped from the 2016 Ghostbusters because that was one of the one of Kate McKinnon's little inventions.
That is a good point.
Like, that's the thing. It's like, this is Easter. I mean, we're talking before the show, it's almost Easter. But, you know, so it's kind of nice that we get an Easter egg movie. That's what this should have been. It's Easter egg movie, because there's, like, literally a point where Paul Rudd holds up, like, a Cannibal Girl VHS.
Yes.
Like, look what I found lying around.
I did love that, because Cannibal Girls is one of my top five best horror movies and best Canadian movies of all time.
Well, I'm not angry at the movie. I'm angry at the he might as well have held up a copy of Stripes. It's like that's the level of pandering. And the thing is, I don't want to be entirely negative. Like, there's residue of interesting stuff going on, and I feel like this is maybe, like, the Gil Kean, because I love Gil Kean, I love Monster House, I loved his City of Ember, I even thought his Poltergeist remake was okay. Like, he's a creative guy, and it comes out around the edges in this, like the scene where Phoebe goes to the park and meets Melody, this ghost who died in a tenement fire. And, you know, they have this exchange as they're playing chess in the park. Like, I thought that was a really great little scene. I mean, I hate where it leads because, you know, it's like, look at the matchbook she has. Remember this matchbook for later. Mm-hmm. But the scene itself was great. And then when, like, she goes to the diner and Melody's sitting there, and you go outside and the diner's called Melody's. It's like, that stuff is really great. And I like the Slimer bit with Trevor. Like, I like the scene where he's, like, laying out the trail of Cheetos to try and lure. Like, I would have, if they had made all that, like, a whole subplot in the movie that he's just, like, trying to get Slimer the whole, like, that would have been fine. But these things are just so few and far between. And when I look at what's wrong with the movie. It's summed up in one perfect scene. It's when Ray's doing stuff in the bookshop and the Ecto-1 goes past the window and he looks out longingly. Because here's a man who spent 25 years of his life trying to turn Ghostbusters into a franchise that just cranks out a movie every 3 to 5 years, and he's finally done it. And now he's just like the legacy guy who's...
Yeah. Though, I mean, just on that sort of legacy stuff,
yeah,
I do love that Ernie Hudson is in this. I appreciated his being, you know, at the end of Afterlife.
Yeah.
And I love that he's, you know, of the four of them, Ghostbusters, he is the one who carries on the legacy, whereas the other ones don't. I'm like, this is great. I think it's great for the character. I think it's great for Ernie Hudson. It's writing some wrongs that, you know, maybe shouldn't have taken so long to write.
Yeah.
But I also just love it story-wise because, you know, he goes out of his way to talk to Ray about, like, Ray, like, you gotta, like, chill and calm down. And the thing is like, all of the other three were all scientists. They're all very passionate about doing what they do, including the ghost stuff. But Winston was not. Like, he was just, like, looking for a job.
Yeah. As long as there's a steady paycheck in it, I'll believe anything you say. That's,
but yet,
that's
he's
the line.
The one who continues, it. He's the one who chooses it. It's not part of his, like, DNA to be there. So he's actively choosing this and choosing it in a real, like, level-headed sort of way, which is why he's able to grow it so much. And I love that we don't actually find out why he's a famed philanthropist. We don't find out where he made his money.
Yeah.
It's great. He's just now a man of power and level-headed and continues to choose to do this work because it's good work and it's right. And not because he has some sort of weird longing for ghosts that, you know, Ray always had a little bit of a weird relationship with those ghosts.
It was interesting where Phoebe asks him, like, you ever wondered what it's like to be a ghost? And he has this, like, oh, every day. I took that as almost like a metatextual moment. And I don't know if that, I doubt it was intended. Because, of course, as we were saying before, the Aykroyd family has this, like, this, I don't know if it's a tradition, but, like, this experience with, like, realms of spiritualism. Dan Aykroyd, along with doing Ghostbusters stuff, you know, he does this show on the History Network called The Unbelievable, which is essentially warmed over bits from Ancient Aliens and the William Shatner show. But, it, you know, it gets to the same realm of things. He has a passion for this stuff. And when they're writing the scripts, it was Ramis and Reitman who were constantly like, you know, Dan, like, this is all great stuff, but the jokes come first before the ephemera. you know, you can talk about Tunguska all day long, but, you know, you got to be funny too. And I feel like, I don't know how much creative influence Aykroyd has on this, but I had a lot of, like, Dial of Destiny vibes, where it's like, you had that franchise, which was based around three creatives, Lucas, Spielberg, Ford, and then you have Ghostbusters, which is also a franchise based on three creatives, Reitman, Ramis, and Aykroyd. And then there was one. Ford, I mean, Ford is Indiana Jones. He embodies that character. He embodies the spirit. No one else can play that character, arguably. But he's still there. And it's like, we're doing this because we can, because we have one piece of this left. And it feels very similar for this too. I don't think, I mean, Aykroyd was one of the main creative forces, but I think he was the one, I'm not going to say he wasn't important, but, you know, you needed that moderating influence of Reitman and Ramis, who were going for the funny and not just for, like, the being the Wikipedia page for hauntings, which is what Aykroyd brings to it. So it feels like there's something missing. You get a piece of something, but the magic of what made that thing just isn't there. And I'm not saying this isn't fun or enjoyable. Like, again, there are parts of this I thought were really fun. You talked about marshmallow men torturing and maiming each other.
Great. It was good stuff.
So, I mean, there's stuff, good stuff in this. Like, I like the possessor ghost who could only, like, you know, manifest, like, inside objects.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that was a good gag. But then they go, like you said, they go to the library. And who do they encounter? The librarian from the first one.
Yeah. Why? There's no need for that.
There's no need. There's no need.
Yeah. 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 There was so many times I was like, there's no need for this. Like, we can just tell a story. Like, yeah. Even having the mayor there, I was like, why are we doing this?
He was there so somebody at the end can call him D-I-C-K-less.
Yes.
That's why. Like,
but why? Like, nobody, we didn't need it. Nobody no. was asking for it.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's nice that William Atherton has gotten some work, but you know, I say what you want about the 2016 Ghostbusters and a lot of people have said things, but like, at least Andy Garcia playing the mayor was like a kind of like a new character. You know, he wasn't like playing mm-hmm. like the mayor from the first two movies, or you have William Atherton here. It's, you know, it's okay to do different stuff. Like,
yeah,
it, like, this whole movie seems to be that Leonardo DiCaprio from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood meme. It's like you sitting in a chair pointing at the screen because you see something.
Yeah. And yeah.
Like, okay, that's fine. And that may appeal to a lot of people. But, you know, at some point, you got to start cooking with some new stuff. And you have stuff here. Like, Carrie Coon and Paul Rudd are very good together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, McKenna Grace as Phoebe. I mean, yeah, she's the focus here, but I feel like her storyline here is exactly the same as it was in Afterlife. I don't fit in. I feel alone. I feel kind of outcast. And then, you know, Finn Wolfhard's not doing anything.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't know why he couldn't have been the Fire Master. That would have been a way to, like, make some room in this, create some breathing room and...
Give him something to do?
Give him something to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I always,
I mean, not that
things,
I don't but... want to see Kumail Nanjiani. I love him. I think it's great. I'm so glad that he gets work because he is so funny.
Yeah.
But
like,
yeah.
I don't need him. I didn't need podcast. I didn't need Lucky. I was
right. Yeah.
When like both of them appear, I was like, oh yeah, them.
And like, what is it? They're Oklahoma, right?
Yes.
Podcast is doing, like, working for Ray in New York City on summer exchange or internship or whatever, even though he tells his parents he's at space camp. I'm like,
which means, like, he's
how
pegged.
Did you get here?
Like, Ray could be arrested for kidnapping because all we have is his kid's word for it that he wanted to work for Ray and not go, like,
yeah,
it's so insane. And then there's this other guy played by James Ancaster, who's like the, like, Winston's main scientist guy, who I swear is only here because he's blonde, curly, and he looks like Egon from the cartoon.
Yeah, he was definitely kind of the nerdy vibe going on.
Yeah, like that's why he's here.
Yeah.
And we again, there's like scary stuff going on. There's threat of world impending doom. No one ever dies. It's it's such a profound letdown. And like, Emily Allen Lind, who plays the Melody Ghost, I thought she was great.
Yeah.
Like, that's something they could have really worked out. Like, that seems like a really interesting angle, because it's like an us versus ghost thing. And most of the time in these movies, well, you know, what if a ghost isn't so bad? You know, what if a ghost is like lonely and alone and trying to figure out why they're a ghost and how they could, like, that's an interesting detail they could have scrubbed with, but no, it becomes a whole thing. And, you know, there's a lot going on here, but they don't do a lot with it, which is just profoundly disappointing, because it turned out, like, I didn't think there was a lot going on with Afterlife, but it turns out you do have a lot going on with Afterlife. Because you have, like, at least the unique setting of Oklahoma.
I love
really
the first,
Alberta,
like,
but
yeah, I love the first, like, two-thirds of Afterlife.
I did too,
it was, it felt new and fresh and, you know, a little, not spooky, but like, you know, Phoebe, getting to know her grandfather, who's sort of like, you know, haunting the place. It was really nice. And then I was like, oh, but now we're just telling the first Ghostbusters story again. Like, it's literally the exact same god and the exact same rules and the exact same everything. Like, what? We all saw that movie already.
I remember watching Afterlife, and literally the first scene is like this truck leaving the mine, and the camera pans down and you see Shandor Mining Company. I literally went, because I knew what was coming, because I've seen Ghostbusters 300 times, and I know who Ivor Shandor is. And so it just, you know, I mean, then the movie started and I kind of was getting into it, and then you get to the end, and I mean, I do, it does make me tickle that Ivor Shandor was played by J.K. Simmons, and he had like this little Lennon-esque thing, but yeah, it's at least you had a movie there. At least I felt like there was a movie with Afterlife.
And Paul Rudd got to do things.
He had a beard, so it was like, here he just feels like Paul Rudd again. Like, it's not like he doesn't not do Paul Rudd, but it felt like he was playing a character in Afterlife. Here he's playing Paul Rudd.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I like Paul Rudd. He's a charming man, but it's you know, you got to give me more than Paul Rudd. Or you got to at least,
or give me more Paul Rudd. Like,
create an opportunity to give me Paul Rudd.
Yeah. There was so much going on, but yet we got so little of a story. Like, that's what I was just like, why are we doing all these things? Why can't we just tell a story?
It's so weird. And it's, we got the trailer this week for the Beetlejuice sequel, or a teaser. And that's one of those, like, this is one of those things I like have my eye on. And I see so many people excited about this, and I'm like, guys, really? Like, you've lived through Ghostbusters Afterlife, and like, you're excited about this? Like, granted, there was nothing in the trailer that was really, that I kind of like created an offense inside me, but there's nothing there that really has me like excited that they're going to do something new and interesting.
I mean, but this is the post Marvel Kingdom world, though, because before it was all Marvel all the time, and now Marvel's not doing anything, so it's like, oh no, what do we do? Oh, let's just revamp all these things from the 80s, where all the people who are, you know, 45 to 60 all were huge fans of, because they'll all come back for this. And sadly, some people are showing excitement for that, and I'm like, stop, and don't encourage them. I just spent, like, last weekend I watched a bunch of the Oscar movies. I watched Past Lives, I watched Poor Things, I watched The Holdovers. These movies are great. Why can't we get more of this?
Or even not just like, can we get more of something that is trying something, I guess, too, is like, you know, it's as you said, you get more, but you're getting less. And it just, like, you can take chances. Like, the ghost heads are going to show up for anything Ghostbusters. So why not take a chance? I mean,
like, sorry to get on a TV tangent, but X-Men 97. I will say, actually, you know, granted, it's only been two episodes, but you're right. There is a way to bring back a beloved franchise from the 80s and make it a thing. Make it make it say something. Make it have some reason for being.
Yeah, that's actually a good example. You're right. All right. So takeaway from today's episode is watch X-Men 97. Not the worst
Empire,
way to leave it.
Yeah, Frozen Empire. It's certainly a movie.
It's a movie that happened.
And they serve popcorn at the movies. So
yeah, it happened.
Yeah.
But that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, and you can stay connected to us by downloading This episode and all episodes of our show every Friday from our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can get it at the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through your favorite app like Apple, Google, TuneIn, and Spotify. And speaking of Spotify, you can find the playlist for much of the music that you hear on End Credits. Just open up End Credits on CFRU when you are in your Spotify app. And you can stay connected to us on social media or on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, and we're on the Twitter at End Credits Radio. As for CFRU, I will be back on tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics for Open Source as Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or check out my news and politics site at GuelphPolitico.ca, which leaves Candace, who will tell us where we can find her out there on the internet.
Yes, you can find me everywhere on the internet at Cinn48, that's CINN48. And you can also hear the newest episode of the Village podcast from the Bookshelf, which was just released at the end of last week. So fresh book talk for you. But not like TikTok. I mean, talk with an AL.
Wow, that's not where I thought that was going, but that's okay. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We shall return next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for another End Credits, and we will, of course, see you then.